Thank you very much. We have the session this evening, and then we take a break again.
No, but we have a picture of your grandson. You may want to show it.
Oh, you saw it this morning. Okay. Since Francis mentioned the most important thing of all, let's see if I can.
Oh, very cute.
That is Eden Yiftach at 5 months.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Picture time, right. Preparation for the Talmud. We have begun again, and next week, next Wednesday, is Leila Seder. The following week is Yom Tov, and then we'll be strong the week after that. We'll be back. Okay, so another 3 weeks. 3 weeks. 2 weeks off, and then we'll come back the third week. Okay? All these little kids are a pleasure, no? Okay. Now, to recall where we were when we left off, which was a little while ago. Maybe you want to just, well, look at the Mishnah on 19a1. That's a little back. We had done that last time. But I think it would be... still toothless.
Yeah, what a face.
He's a funny kid. He's cute. He's adorable.
Very resolute.
Resolute, yes. Takes after his parents and his grandparents. The Mishnah on 19a, it's 19a1 in the English. Let's just look at that again, because throughout the evening tonight we'll be making reference to that Mishnah. Hakoveret meto shlosha yamim kodem laregel. Whoever buries his dead 3 days before the festival begins. Okay? So there's been a death, and the burial occurs 3 days before the regel. So now. Batlai menu gzerat shiva. So the death occurs, 3 days pass, and then the regel begins. The Mishnah says, which to us is very surprising, that shiva is cancelled. Because that's not the law that we know. We know the law that if the regel comes, if it's a festival, and you have observed how much before the festival?
A day.
A day? Something. A little bit. Do you observe an hour before the festival? And the festival comes. That's the end of Shiva. The end of Shiva. Same thing as far as Shloshim goes. But that is not the law of the Mishnah. That's not the law of the Mishnah. Mishnah says, if 3 days pass... Now, of course, if then 2 days passed, you'd have to pick up after the festival is over. So here we're coming up to Pesach. All right? If, God forbid, you had a loss, and 3 days before, so Pesach starts Wednesday night. Wednesday, Tuesday, Monday. Okay? Sunday. So if you buried on...
Sunday.
Well, that's not clear. It could be even Monday.
Could be Monday.
Because it depends on what's day one. Right? Day one would be Monday in all likelihood. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday comes Pesach. How much shiva do you have after the holiday?
No.
Nothing, according to the Mishnah. Okay? has to be at least 3 days. Has to be at least 3 days. If it's 4 days, three, four, whatever it is. Okay?
Suppose
but not less.
It's only 1 day before the holiday.
Then the festival does not cancel the Shiva. And therefore you have to pick up the Shiva after the holiday. Exactly. So you've had 1 day, and it would seem logical that you would have 6 days afterwards. Naturally, as you well know, logic may or may not have anything to do with this discussion, but you're quite right. Logically, it would seem one, then you'd add six. Two, you'd add five.
But three, it's finished.
Three, it's finished, according to the Mishnah. But don't learn that, because that's not the law. Okay? You can't always believe everything you read, even if it's in the Mishnah. Okay, but lai menu gzerat shiva shmona, and if 8 days have passed, but lu mihimenu gzerat shloshim. Right, if you have 8 days, so you finished your shiva 7 days, then you have an 8th day. Right, if that has happened and then the festival comes, it's over. Okay? Shloshim is over. That too, I warn you, that's not the law, but that's the Mishnah. Okay? Let's see. Those are the important parts, but let's go on. Shabbat Ola ve'eina mafseket. Remember that Shabbat counts in the counting of Shiva, but it doesn't stop the Shiva. It doesn't cancel the Shiva. Mipnei shamru regalim mafsikim ve'enan olim. Somehow, it's not clear how the mipnei shamru, but the regalim mafsikim ve'enan olim. But when the regal comes and stops something, it doesn't count, whatever that means. Rabbi Eliezer Omer... Well, let's not read this. We discussed that last time. If you remember it, that's great. If you don't remember it, it's a loss. Okay. We won't give you a test. Let's go now to 19b1. Now, again, to recall what we had read last time, 19b1 contains the law that we met earlier on in the Gemara, which is the point of view of Abba Shaul. Abba Shaul has this apparently radical idea that Miktzat Hayom Kechulo, a part of a day is considered a whole day. Okay? And that will affect a variety of things. It will affect the Shiva. It will affect the Shloshim. However long the Shiva is, if the regal comes and stops it, we want to know how long it has to be. What is the third day? When does the third day end, as far as Shiva is concerned? Does it end in the evening? Does it end in the day? Okay. Does it end at the end of the day? Abba Shaul says that Miktzat Hayom Kechulo, a little bit of the day is like a whole day. In fact, what he means is not a little bit of the day per se, but a little bit of the daytime.
So not
the night. Correct. Not the night. What we ended with last time, if you remember, was that I had read to you the Shulchan Aruch. And the Shulchan Aruch says that the Shiva is over after people leave the minyan in the morning. They leave the minyan in the morning. And the force of that was to say, not the minyan in the evening, but the minyan in the morning. And according to Abba Shaul, who says, Miktzat Hayom Kechulo, part of a day is a whole day, that means a part of the daytime is the whole day. Not day per se, but daytime. Okay? And according to the Shulchan Aruch, it was a short amount of time which was measured by when people left the minyan in the morning. Because apparently what used to be the case was that people would leave the minyan and they would go pay a shiva call. So that became the crucial dividing point. After the minyan was the end of the shiva. And that's, in fact, what we observe till today. Okay? But that was the point of view then of Abba Shaul. Abba Shaul. Okay? Let's see. Abba Shaul, therefore, differed with the rabbis. And he differed with the rabbis on two things. First of all, the rabbis said they didn't believe in this Mikzat HaYom Kechulo. They didn't take a part of the day as the whole day. To them, it had to be a whole day. Abba Shaul was a part of the day. To the rabbis, it was the whole day. Okay, they differed on that. They also differed on something else. Abba Shaul said that if you've completed your shiva, and the seventh day is Erev Yom Tov. Seventh day is Erev Yom Tov, okay? So if it were this next week, the seventh day of your shiva would be on Wednesday, okay? Abba Shaul says, okay, that the Shloshim is canceled. The rabbis said in the Mishnah that if 8 days have passed and the regel comes, your shloshim is canceled. Abba Shaul therefore says if 7 days have passed, the shloshim is canceled. The rabbis say if 8 days have passed, the shloshim is canceled. The truth is that Abba Shaul is consistent and the rabbis are consistent. Why? The last thing that we read was that according to Abba Shaul, if part of the day is like a whole day, then that seventh day of your shiva, which is next Wednesday, it counts both as the seventh day and as the eighth day. Because according to Abba Shaul, a part of the day is a whole day. So it ends next Wednesday morning, early in the morning, after the minyan. Okay? And that day then, which is the seventh day, is sort of the seventh, it's sort of the eighth. And he's consistent in his perspective, as other rabbis. So they actually differ on two things. Miktzat HaYom Kechulo, whether part of the day is equal to the whole day, and whether you have to have 7 days or 8 days before you cancel the Shloshim. Okay? That, if you remember, is where we left some while ago. Now we are on 19b1 on the right-hand side of the page, the last paragraph. Okay. Kiman azlaha diamarav amram amarah. Like which of the sages that we have studied so far goes the opinion of Rav Amram, who spoke in the name of Rav, to say the following. Avel kevan she'amdu menachamim mi'atzlo mutar birchitza. And Avel, somebody who is observing mourning, that is to say Shiva. Avel refers specifically here to Shiva. Somebody who is observing Shiva. Okay? Kevan she'amdu menachamim mi'atzlo. As soon as the comforters get up from extending their condolences. And we already know from our last time, when is that on the seventh day? After the minyan, early in the morning. That was the custom during the time of the Talmud. Okay? So, Avel kevan she'amdu menachamim mi'atzlo, as soon as the comforters have gotten up from saying their condolences to him, mutar birechitza, he is permitted already to wash. Now remember, washing is prohibited during Shiva, except for hygienic washing. Showering, bathing, that's all prohibited during Shiva. May not be the case for us in our society, because we're what you call istanis. And istanis is somebody who is overly concerned about his cleanliness. In a way, that's a social reality with which we live. Ever so many people in our society are not neurotic, I don't think, but they take a shower every day. Do you ever hear people take a shower every day? Probably most of us take a shower every day. Okay. In the ancient world, nobody took a shower every day. You never did anything like that. Except people who were neurotic. Okay? If there was something wrong with you, you had to always do things like that. Okay? So I'm saying that what we are reading here now, even in terms of Shiva, the kinds of cleanliness that are permissible in Shiva, I think, are actually somewhat different today than they were in the times of the Talmud. But in the time of the Talmud, there's no doubt about the fact that you were not allowed to wash on a daily basis. Okay? You couldn't, and washing means the whole body. The whole body.
What was that word?
Istinus. Aleph, Yud, Samach, Tet, Nud, Samach. I suspect that it is a Greek word, but I'm not sure. It's either Aramaic or Greek.
What is it called?
Istinus. Do you say it in modern Hebrew?
No. I've always known it.
You always know it?
You know it, but you don't use it.
You don't use it.
I think it's still used.
Correct. An istinus is somebody who is obsessed with cleanliness. Right. I see istinus is very interesting.
You've never heard of it. Okay. None of us knew it, so should we pay attention to each word?
Excellent. What could be better? Okay. So, when the Talmud says that a person is permitted to wash, the force of that is to say that Shiva is over. I mean, that's what it is saying. So in our terms, legal terms, it means Shiva is over. Shiva is over. Okay, so it says, Kimanas lahadi amarav avram amarav. This point of view that we're now going to read, which is the point of view of Rav, which says, a mourner, when the people have gotten up from comforting him, he is permissible, it is permissible for him to wash his whole body. Kiman, whose point of view does this reflect? Ki Abba Shaul, it reflects Abba Shaul's point of view. Abba Shaul again said, Miktzata Yom Kechulo, part of the day is a whole day. We know, therefore, that when people get up from paying a condolence call, is on the seventh day of Shiva, after the minyan, and therefore that is in accord with the point of view of Abba Shaul. Because it says, in effect, that after the minyan, Shiva is over. Ipso facto, miktzata yom kechulo. Part of a day is counted like a whole day. So, come on, according to whom? Whose point of view is this? Abba Shaul's. Okay? Next page. Amar Abaye says, Halachaka Abba Shaul biyom shiva. Abaye says, now, Abaye is an Amara. All right? What we have read, Abba Shaul is a Tana. So Abaye the Amara says, Halacha ka Abba Shaul biyom shiva. The law goes according to Abba Shaul on the seventh day of the Shiva. Umodim chachamim la'Abba Shaul. Not only that, but the sages agree with Abba Shaul. B'yom shloshim, di'amrinen mitzata yom kecholah. That where we say, where Abba Shaul said, the sages, namely the rabbis of the Talmud, the rabbis of the Mishnah, agree that on the day of shloshim, part of a day is like a whole day. Okay? Now, which is to say, on the day of Shiva, what do the rabbis say? Do the rabbis agree with Abba Shaul?
Nope.
No, they do not agree with Abba Shaul. They agree, the rabbis think that on the day of the seventh day of Shiva, you have to observe a whole day. But they agree with Abba Shaul, who said, no, only a part of the day in the last day of Shiva is a whole day. They agree, as far as Shloshim goes, that the last day of Shloshim, Miktzata Yom Kehula, part of the day is like a whole day. Okay? So that's what Abaye says.
Who are the Chachamim?
Chachamim means the rabbis of the Mishnah here.
The rabbis of the Mishnah.
Okay. It means the rabbis of the Mishnah in this context.
Who are also Tanaim.
Who are also Tanaim, correct. So Abba Shaul was a Tana, but he is apparently reflecting a minority point of view. Apparently. Okay? When you see a statement like Chachamim, that is reflecting back on the Mishnah. The Mishnah came without any minority point of view. And it's interesting. Very frequently, the Mishnah will come with a minority point of view. So, and so they'll make a statement. This is the law. But Rabbi so-and-so says the following. He disagrees. That was not the form of the Mishnah here. It was only in the Gemara that we met Abba Shaul, who is brought in a Baraita, disagreeing with the Chachamim, who in this case are the rabbis of the Mishnah, the Tanaim.
So is the Gemara saying that today, at the time of the, at their time, the time of the Amoraim, let's say, that the law now is according to Abba Shaul?
Well, not exactly, because you have, this is Abaye is saying this. And the next thing the Gemara says is Rava Amar Halachaka Abba Shaul Biyom Shloshim. Rava, remember Abaye and Rava were Bere Plukta. They were the disputants with each other. They were contemporaries. They studied with each other. And not infrequently, one will say one thing, one will say the other thing. So if we say the Amoraim, we can't really say that at this stage, because Rava has said one thing, and now we're going to see that Abaye more or less agrees, but not entirely agrees. And they lived together. They were contemporaries with each other. Okay, Rava says halachaka Abba Shaul biyom shloshim. He says yes. The law is according to Abba Shaul on the 30th day. That is to say, miktzata yom kechula. Okay. Ve'ein halachaka Abba Shaul biyom shiva. That's a Rava says that the law is not according to Abba Shaul on shiva. Okay. Next, the Nahardae, the people of Nahardaea. Nahardaea was one of the principal cities of Babylonia. Okay? There are three cities of Babylonia that are the source of the Talmud: Sura, Pumbedita, and Nahardaea. These are all cities in Iraq today. I don't know what they're called today.
Well, I know Pumbedita is...
Surah, I think it's the city.
It's still called Surah?
Yeah.
Pumbedita is what? It was one of these cities that was in this guy Najaf. I think I heard there was one of these cities. I'm not sure.
One of the names of the cities today.
I don't know what they are today. I don't know.
What area is it in?
Iraq. More than that, I can't tell. I'm not an expert in Iraqi geography. Not yet. So, when we thought the Iraq war was going to be over, Chatzstein, all the Jewish organizations had already made reservations for the UJA missions. There were a whole bunch of UJA missions, and I was already to sign up. That petered out.
I wonder why.
We didn't buy enough body armor.
Well, whatever it was, it didn't work out exactly the way we thought it would. But, Bezat Hashem, down the road, we should be taking these tours and we'll figure out what the names of these cities are, because these are major cities.
There's mosaics on the floors of synagogue still.
I'm sure that there are.
The Dutch have excavated.
What?
The
city
of
Iraq where they had, it slipped my mind what Pumbedita was, the city where where they had to go in with heavy force, and there was street by street battles.
Fallujah.
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 Yeah,
Fallujah.
That's which?
That's Pampadita.
How do you know that?
I read in the Biblical Archaeology Review.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Fallujah. Very good. Nahardah, we'll get to see. Okay. Nahardah, it says, Unahardah Amre, the residents, assuming also probably the sages, but here it says Nahardah, the custom in Nahardah was, Halachaka Abba Shaul Bezo Bezo. They agree with Abba Shaul in both cases. That is to say, the Shiva is Miksatayom Kecholo, the seventh day of Shiva is a partial day, and the 30th day is also a partial day. Okay? Okay, now, let's see whether there's... The Amar Shmuel, and it's interesting, the Nahardah, Shmuel lived in the Harda'ah. So they followed his view, and it wasn't only a matter of this being legal precedent that they followed what he said. But there's a reason for it. De'amar Shmuel. Shmuel had already enunciated a general principle. He is in the first generation of the Amoraim, living in the Harda'ah, is the head of the yeshiva Narda, halacha kedivrei amekel ba'avel. That's the principle. That the law goes according to the lenient point of view when it concerns mourning. So since the lenient point of view happens to be, in this case, Abba Shaul's point of view, that a part of the day, both in terms of Shiva and in terms of Shloshim, counts as a whole day, because they know the reasoning, they accept the point of view of Abba Shaul. Okay? Any questions? Yes?
Is there any indication that shows us how Abba Shaul came to the conclusion that part of a day is a day?
No. I don't think that there is.
Oh, that's because the day starts the night before, and he said that already two-thirds already passed, basically.
Possibly. But he doesn't say it. As far as I know, he doesn't say it. So it could be the view that was just expressed by Shmuel, that basically it's a Mekel point of view. It's a lenient point of view. And since the lenient point of view governs in the area of mourning, that he just takes that point of view. Or it could be it was custom. It's hard to say, because we don't know. He doesn't articulate.
We do know that if... you have Shiva on Friday before Shabbat, you can use part of the day. There are already situations that you're allowed to cut the day short to do the other stuff.
Correct. But that, remember, was from the perspective, from the point of view of the Chachamim, of the rabbis.
And Abba Shaul just instituted as Amikel.
Well, maybe. Yeah. But it also could be the opposite way.
Correct.
It could be that Abba Shaul already had his point of view, and the rabbi said, well, when it's on a Friday, we go according to Abba Shaul. All right, so it's hard to say which came first.
But there is no any indication.
No, not that I know.
How it came to be.
No, it's not in the text. Not in the text.
Two things. One is, it appears as though they want to, that there's a desire to cut this shorter to be lenient in mourning. Is there any indication why they would want to, like, really cut out the whole shloshim, the whole 30 days, you know, by making this technicality about 7 versus 8 days to really cut out the whole shloshim, and also a kind of an impulse to cut it? Because I would think that people would want to actually express the full mourning.
It's an interesting issue. I don't really know the answer to that. You can see that in the Talmudic period, it was felt that it was a burden.
Yeah.
It was felt that it was a burden. It was an economic burden. I mean, it was an economic burden. It's hard to make a living. People are not particularly secure. And it's also a burden of observance. There are a lot of observances that are here. There's a sexual burden, right? There is a burden of lack of washing. You know, you have to turn around and not do the things you normally do.
That's a community's burden.
And it's a community burden. That's also true.
Especially if they're not washing.
Well, and the community has the burden of visiting, too.
They have more significant than others. I mean, there's really only a handful of instances in which this is an obligation. Did they have?
Well, it is. I mean, the law is today the same as it was then. We're talking about the close relatives. Right. The Shiva does not extend beyond the close relatives.
Two times in a lifetime. Correct. Correct. So it's more.
Correct.
Childhood.
No, that's true. The child is an important thing to remember. That is quite right. That they would have had a major piece of their experience would have been the death of children. That's correct. Not children right after childbirth, because you have a period of a month, 1 month.
1 month or 3 months?
It's 1 month. 1 month when, if a child dies during that first month, there's no Shiva. There's no Shiva. But post that, and I'm sure, given the reality of the ancient world, most, I suspect, there's a certain amount of immediate death, but probably a great deal of death in childhood, which is to say the first 20 years of life, probably. Years ago, when I was working and lecturing on the subject of old age, I was out in Ohio at an interfaith conference on this, death and dying, and one series of lectures was on old age. So there was a Protestant biblical scholar who said the following. He said in the ancient world, people died early. They died early in life, and therefore there were no old people. Or relatively speaking, there are very few old people. And then I got up and gave my lecture where I proved that was not the case. It was not the case. What happened was that many people died in childhood. And this I can prove from the Talmud. But if you could outlast childhood, if you lasted to get married, which was about 18 to 20, the assumption was that you would live to 60. So that it must mean, I mean, 60. So it must mean that that was the reality. The reality was that given what you could expect, if you made it that far, you could then make it the next piece. And people died at 60 and at 70.
Yeah, the biggest knock on modern medicine is, for all of its great advances, in fact, it's done nothing to the actual extension of human life. Because there are many examples of people living more or less to the age they do now. It's just the fraction that makes it so much higher.
Exactly. So, mourning for children was obvious. I think was probably
was a
common thing, and was that was something people would surely have seen a lot of. So keep that in mind in terms of the common experience. You didn't have birth control, so you had a lot of children, and a lot of children died.
No, and they wanted a lot of children. It was
So it was a value as well. Correct.
Also, if people had a lot of siblings, they would...
And that's also true. As a result of all of that, you'd end up with a lot of siblings. Surely more than we have today. You know, even if it wasn't dozens, you didn't have modern medicine. Indeed, it was probably still, families must have been 8-10 people, probably.
Well, these are factors in terms of, you know, cost, in terms of time.
Exactly. So the frequency of all of this, we shouldn't think that it didn't happen. Our sense, let us say that ever so often, I mean, I've always seen throughout my rabbinate that young people usually don't experience a death until they're in their 20s, most commonly. and it's a grandparent in most cases. If you go back a relatively short period of time, many young people experience the death of a parent.
Many young people
experience the death of a parent. A parent. Even when I was young, there were numerous people. Today, when a parent dies, I mean, it happens, but it's a major disaster. It's considered to be very unusual. Mm. It's very unusual when that happens. Your children who are in school, when a parent of a child in a class dies, it's a major, major thing. For most children, it's the death of their grandparents that is their first experience with death. Okay? So that's a very, very different reality than what you're seeing reflected here. Okay, let's see. We're on 19b2. We see the points of view of Abaya, Rava, and the Nahardeim, and we see that the law is, according to Shmuel, that the law is according to Abba Shaul, because it is always lenient in terms of mourning. Now, we go to a somewhat different subject, but we'll come back to this subject again. We go to the subject of shaving or hair cutting during Shloshim. Now, just a review. Remember that cutting of the hair is prohibited in Shiva, in Shloshim, and where else? Who else is prohibited to cut? The Nazirite, correct? But there is also a mourning prohibition that goes beyond Shloshim.
Children
for a parent. For when a parent dies, the cutting of hair is prohibited for an entire year. Okay? So that you have a variety of gradations here. When the Gemara is speaking of shaving, it is giving a modern Hebrew translation of giluach, which we translate as shaving. But galeach in Hebrew in the time of the Talmud means cutting of the hair. And in all likelihood, what they were doing was cutting their beards. And they didn't shave. They trimmed the beard, and trimming of the hair on the top of the head is trimming of the hair on the bottom of the head. It's the same Hebrew. So that's what we're talking about. Shloshim yomin alan. How do we know that you are not allowed to cut the hair for 30 days? Yalif pera pera min nazir. We learn it because there are two uses of the Hebrew word, the root peresh ayin. One concerns mourning, and one concerns the Nazirite. Peresh ayin means to let the hair grow wild. That's what it means. Parua is wild. Peradam is... But that's with an aleph. It's actually with an aleph. But it means the same thing. The ayin is the same as the aleph. So parua in terms of the hair is wild hair. It's wild hair. Okay? Yalif pera pera min nazir. This is a gzerah shavah. Remember the definition of a gzerah shavah. Gzerah shavah means that there are two verses in the Torah that contain the same root. In one of the verses, something is defined that is left undefined in the second verse. And therefore, when you have a gzerah shavah, which presupposes a tradition of interpretation, that in as it means something in the first context, so it means the same something in the second context. And here we will see the Gzeirah Shavah. Ketiv hacha, it is written, in the case of mourning, Roshechem al tifrau. That's the case of Aaron and his sons. When Nadav and Avihu are struck down. Right? Moses says to them, Roshecham al tifrau. Do not let your hair grow wild, because they're in a special case. They are Kohanim, ministering in the Mishkan. They are not allowed to observe the laws of mourning. Right? They're a totally unique case.
That's in this next Shabbat.
It's
or 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Shmini, I think it's 2 weeks. Okay? So that's what it says. They're not allowed to observe the mourning. And then it says, Lo tifra'u. Tifra'u. Pei resh ayin is the root. All right? Uketiv hatam. Elsewhere it is written in the Torah, Gadel pera sa'arosho. He, the Nazarite, shall let the pera, the growth, the wild growth of sa'arosho, of the hair of his head, grow. The Nazarite shall let it grow. So we see it's pera and it's pera. Peresh ayin, peresh ayin. Now the verite that goes on and says, Malahalan shloshim, as we know in the case of a Nazarite, that a Nazarite is a Nazarite for at least 30 days. The basic definition of a Nazarite is somebody who has taken upon himself that those restrictions for a 30-day period. You can take on more, but it's at least 30. As we learn in the case of the Nazarite, that it's 30. Lahalan shloshim afkan shloshim. Likewise here, in the case of the mourner, which mourner? The mourner that we just read about. The sons of Aaron. Aaron and his sons. They are mourners. Pera. The Nazarite. Pera. How long is a Nazarite? 30 days. How long is a mourner? 30 days.
I thought the Nazarite was for a year.
Now, a Nazarite can be longer. A Nazarite can say, I take upon myself the restrictions of being a Nazarite for a year. Then he has it for a year. But if he says the following, I declare that I shall be a Nazarite. Okay? He hasn't said how long. How long has he subjected himself to? According to the Talmud, it's 30 days. He can extend that period by explicitly stating it, but if he states nothing, we assume it's 30 days. That's the minimal period. Okay? So similarly here, it's the same. As it is defined in one context, so it is defined in another context. That's the Gzeirah Shavah. Now, the Gemara then says, you have just said that the Nazarite is 30 days. How do we know that? Minahala. All right? Hata minahala. There, in case of the Nazarite, how do we know that it's 30 days? You've assumed that just now. What proof do you have for it? Amar Rav Matna, Stam Nizirut Shloshim Yom. Rav Matna says that Stam Nizirut, when a person makes an undefined declaration of Nazariteship, it is for 30 days. Maitama, what's the biblical source of that? Amar Kra Kodesh Yihyeh. That's what it says vis-a-vis the Nazarite. Kodesh Yihyeh. He shall be sanctified. Kodesh Yihyeh. All right? Yihyeh b'gematria tlatin. In gematria, Yihyeh is equal to 30. Yihyeh. Yud is 10. He is 5. 15. Yud, he. 15 and 15 equals 30. 15 and 15 is equal 30. Now, of course, you have 30 days. You're right. You're right. A gematria, just a word about gematria. Is a gematria what you would call a solid proof? Solid proof. Solid proof. I'd like to have a more solid proof. If I were before a judge, I'd prefer something a little stronger than a gematria. So among the Rishonim, the early commentators now on the Talmud, and the people who are making the law, this whole passage is not at all clear, because it's not clear whether, as a result of this gematria, it's proven that this, that the Shloshim is from the Torah, or the other possibility is that gematrias are used as asmachtas. Asmachta is where you already know the law, and the law is considered to be halacha l'Moshe miSinai. It's Torah shebaal peh. It's an oral law. And what we are reading now is an effort by the rabbis to attach it to the written law. So it's no less legal, but it's entirely based on tradition. That's the Torah shebaal peh. So in all likelihood, my reaction to this is that probably this was understood to be the law. It was accepted in the community as being the law. And by being the law, I mean not only sort of custom, but it was halacha l'Moshe miSinai. This was the meaning of the Nazarite always. This was understood to be the meaning of the Nazarite, as you will always have in any legal system, in our American legal system. There may be certain terms in the Constitution that you can argue just have always been understood that way. So, of course, you'll have liberals who read the Constitution and say, well, it may have been understood that way, but it's a Constitution. We can interpret it differently. And then you'll have conservatives who say, well, until now, from the founders until today, this phrase always meant the following. Therefore, it should mean the following in the days to come. That's exactly what you've got here. Where you've got an understanding, halacha l'Moshe miSinai, about the Nazarite, that it means 30 days, the rabbis wanted to find the scriptural way to pin it, something they could pin it on, some verse in the scripture. So they use a gematria for that purpose. So I don't think that the force of a gematria is really strong. I think a gematria is after the fact. It's not as if you're proving it from the gematria. You already know it. But again, it's not as if because you know it, it's something that can be dismissed and changed. It is halacha l'Moshe miSinai. This is the law to Moses on Mount Sinai, and we simply find a source in the written law to which we can associate that oral law.
This is really the first time I've encountered gematria in the Talmud. Is it used often?
Often, no. It's used occasionally. Mm. Occasionally. Professor Lieberman, in his book Greek in Jewish Palestine, discusses the subject of gematria in the Talmud. He finds some precedent for it also in the Greek Socratic literature, so that it's not unprecedented, and even the term gematria is a Greek word. It's a Greek word. So Lieberman argues that the concept already exists in the Hellenistic world. It is appropriated then in the Talmud. We are most familiar with it through the Kabbalistic tradition. The Kabbalah, it's right and left. Yeah. People say to me always, Chai. Chai means 18. So it's a Chai, it must be in the... Is it in the Torah? No. Is it in the Talmud? No. Is the Kabbalah? Actually, no. It's only in the later Kabbalah that you have this idea of Chai and the relation to 18 and life and all those things. It doesn't appear until the 17th century, as far as I can see. So, but gematria per se actually goes back to the Talmud. You can see it right here.
36 is an ancient number. 36 is a very ancient number. It's Egyptian.
Right? It's Egyptian.
Yeah, and I think that's how I take it. And then maybe the 18 is the half.
Half that.
Because 36 is, that's where the Lamed Vav Tzadikim comes from.
But that's a very old idea in Judaism. I mean, that's probably at the earliest 18th century. For us, 18th century is like the New York Times yesterday.
But it's ancient Egyptian. It's
interesting. Very interesting.
So when you're saying the Greeks used it, though, they used alpha as 1 and omega as whatever.
Apparently they had alpha. Some numerical values. They didn't use it as thoroughly as the rabbis did, but this concept did exist in the Greek world.
It's like the people's right to bear arms in interpretation, because you have the various...
Oh, I see what you're saying. That it's in the Constitution, yeah. And the NRA says one thing,
yes.
And well, others say differently. Okay? Anybody else?
You mentioned this how did the rabbis here feel about the idea that the law in many, putting aside the ones that were clearly rabbinic and snuggling, you know, making a fence around the Torah and so on, but they're trying to understand what the law is. It's not like the Constitution where if you make a mistake, okay, so you made a mistake. It's the Jefferson and others created it, big deal. But they're trying to understand what the divine requirements are, and they don't know. And, or they...
Well, let's say they're not sure.
At least they're not sure, but even they know that hundreds of years before them, people were unsure. They may have decided at some point, but what was there? What do they ever discuss this in the Talmud? What it is that they think they're doing? I mean, are they trying to retrieve something that was lost, or
they don't discuss it? They really don't discuss it. Keep in mind, of course, that the Talmud is itself an oral literature. We are reacting to it as a written literature, but to them, it wasn't a written literature; it was an oral literature. And in a culture where oral literatures define truths, oral things are accepted as true, whereas written things are less accurate than oral ones. We are the opposite. We assume if it's written, it's more accurate, and if it's oral, it's less accurate. But they were the opposite, I think. So they don't really articulate this a great deal. After the close of the Talmud, that is a major issue. For the next 7 centuries, this is discussed and debated. In Maimonides, I'll give you 2 examples. The Gezeirah Shavah that we just read about, okay? We read a Gezeirah Shavah. You have para here, you have para there. So, right after the close of the Talmud, and it's hard to say this because when people read the Talmud, they assume what I'm about to say to you. As far as I can see, it's not in the Talmud. But most people who read the Talmud assume it is in the Talmud because it's so much a part of our way of thinking. The Gezeirah Shavah of Pera, is that a result of individual creativity, legal creativity? Somebody thought it up. And therefore, the next guy could find the next instance of Pera, or he could do something else. The use of, I don't know, yihyeh, the next word that we had. It means, what do we say, it was 30. 30. The yihyeh means always 30. And maybe we could take that every time it appears and see what the implications of it are. That sort of creative jurisprudence. Can you do that? That's sort of implied in what you're saying. Can you do things like that? After the period of the Talmud, by the time you get to the end of the 6th century to the end of the 12th, end of the 13th century, by that time it's completely clear you can't do any of those things. And rather, the notion of the Gezeirah Shavah is that a Gezeirah Shavah is only valid if you have a tradition. It's not logic that makes it valid, but it's tradition that makes it valid. And therefore, the assumption becomes behind every Gezeirah Shavah that it is not the perspicacity of the argument that carries the day, but only the extent to which a person has access to valid tradition. So that it is impossible, according to the later commentators, which is to say after the Talmud, to make up a Gezeirah Shavah. The Gezeirah Shavah itself goes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. It goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai. So there really is no room for creativity in those things. This is all the oral tradition. By the time you get to Maimonides, and Maimonides is writing now at the end of the 11th century, in 1179, he publishes the Mishneh Torah. In his introduction to the Mishneh Torah, he has a rather thoroughgoing and probably the major document of jurisprudence until that point in ancient history. I didn't call that ancient, but that's the end of the 12th century. And there he says quite clearly, if there is any disagreement in the Talmud, and he means it quite literally, he means what he says, if there's any disagreement in the Talmud about a law, then it cannot come from Moses on Mount Sinai. Cannot come. As a matter of principle.
It cannot
come from Moses on Mount Sinai. Because anything that is that significant couldn't have disagreement. If there is disagreement, he says, in 85% of the cases, the reason for the disagreement is not on the law, but on the scriptural source of the law. That's something else. On that, there is and can be disagreement. So something which is Tarasha Baal Peh, Maimonides says, is and has always been the law. If we see that actually what you do is a question, then it cannot be the law of the Torah. So that's why Maimonides, in terms of what we are reading, Maimonides takes a very liberal perspective on all of this. To him, most of this, not all, but most of this is the law of the rabbis. Because it's a disagreement. If there's a disagreement on the basic observance itself, it cannot be from the Torah.
You mean even if it's resolved at the end of the discussion?
Correct. If it doesn't make any difference. If you can see the discussion is based on a disagreement about practice, then it cannot be from the Torah.
The whole Talmud is.
Not according to Maimonides. Therefore, Maimonides, in the introduction to the Mishneh Torah, tries to articulate what the 613 mitzvot are. Right? He tries to articulate what they are. And to tell you the truth, in all those volumes, to get 613 statements that there's no disagreement about is a real job. Okay? That's the 613 commandments of the Torah.
But what about... But he's saying that there are more than 613 commandments because there are... No?
That's maybe yes, maybe no. Because the 613 commandments are of the written law. There may be understandings of those commandments which are part of the oral law. I'll give you an example. The Torah says... Ukshatam laot al yadecha vayudatata v'ben enecha. You shall bind them for a sign upon your hand, and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes. Okay? Nowhere in the Talmud is there ever any thought that means anything other than tefillin. Okay? Tefillin. Now, it doesn't obviously say tefillin, but the oral law says that means tefillin. So what the oral law does is that it frames in our mind the meaning of the written law. Okay? You might say it teaches us something new. Maimonides would say no. When you read the text of the Torah that says, you shall bind them for a sign upon your hands and they shall be for frontlets between your eyes, if you were a literary critic, you could say that means all kinds of things. It could be a way of saying you shall take them seriously. But the oral law tells us, and that is the oral law that goes back to Moses on Mount Sinai, that is the meaning. How do we know? Because the Talmud never disagrees about that interpretation. The Talmud always assumes that interpretation. There may be disagreements on details, and therefore, if there's a disagreement on detail, in all likelihood, it's a later development. So that's my Maimonidean jurisprudence. And not everybody agrees with that, you could be sure.
So, for example, that Shiva concludes the morning of the seventh day, he would say, is not
correct. Torah cannot Mishav. Absolutely cannot be Torah the Moshe Misim.
Right. That the avail, whatever we were learning in the very beginning here, that you know the rules that came from that pasuk in
Vayikra.
The one with the all of the things that they were told not to do, from which we learned that this is what you do, like when we studied about the talis.
Well, there was somewhat different, but here the verse in Leviticus was the verse of Aaron and his sons.
Right.
You shall not do this,
right.
In which we learn what you should do.
Right. But that one was from the prophets.
The later one, correct. Yeah. Correct. The later one was from the prophets.
Which
puts it into question then. But the early one now, what we are just reading now, the prohibition on cutting hair. Is that Torah LeMoshe MiSinai? I would say, from what we have read, it's pretty clear that it is Torah LeMoshe MiSinai, because the Torah itself said it. Right? Not directly, but indirectly. Okay? So it appears that that is Torah LeMoshe MiSinai. Okay? However, whether the fact that it is 30 days is Torah LeMoshe MiSinai, you might wonder about. Because it doesn't say that originally. According to this exposition, though, there is no disagreement on the fact that it is 30 days. Rather, there is a Gzeira Shava. And remember, in defining my terms just now, I said to you that a Gzeira Shava is understood by the later rabbis to be always having been understood that way. It's not legal creativity, Gzeira Shava. Though it may appear to be that, that's not what it is. Therefore, the 30 days itself would be understood by Maimonides to be Torah LeMoshe MiSinai. Okay?
But not what a day is.
Not what a day is, correct. Correct. That would be a later development, exactly.
They found the tefillin on Masada, which predates the Talmud.
Sort of. It's from that period of time, basically. So what does that prove?
It proves that there were traditions
That are at least that old.
Right.
Correct. What it doesn't prove is what's older than that. Like I always say, and I'm working now on some modern theology. I've said it to you before. Let us talk about the truth of the giving of the Torah. Right? That's a problem for a modern person. How can you believe the Torah is true? How can you believe it was given to God by God to Moses on Mount Sinai? Okay. There's one way to prove it. The same way you just said. It is to find physical evidence. So, I say the following. We discovered an MP3. Right?
MP3.
Right? MP3. No, this is just audio. All audio. Simply an audio. Okay? It was in a... what is it? Macintosh? What do you call those players?
iPod.
We found an iPod in the Egyptian desert inside one of these clay things. All right, and we did a carbon-14 test on this. And the carbon-14 test on the MP3 iPod, which has on it, Anochi Hashem Elokecha Asher Hoteiticha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, right? I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt. Okay, all of that, it's on it. Okay, so I'm telling you this. Now, you're listening to me tell you this, and what are you saying? Clever, crazy, one of these things, right? Mm-hmm. Very odd. Mm-hmm. And back in your mind, your rational self is saying, you can't say that. You are being anachronistic. You have created an interesting fantasy which could never exist. And I say to you, that's exactly the point. That's exactly the point. The point is that there is absolutely no way to prove any of these things. These are completely impossible to prove. So the whole expectation that you could have proof, there could never be proof. Oh, maybe there could. In all likelihood, they can't. I said a little bit on Saturday about this conversation we had on the plane a week ago, tonight, the middle of the night. I'm having this conversation with an evangelical minister, a pastor from West Virginia. So we're going, we'd solve all the problems of religion somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And this guy says to me, he says, Rabbi, he says, have you ever heard the Biblical Archaeological Review? Bar, B-A-R, that's what you quoted before. I said, I read the Biblical Archaeological Review. He says, you read it? I said, of course I read it. So then we start discussing the Biblical Archaeological Review. He's in love with this journal, which, by the way, if you haven't read it, is an absolutely wonderful journal to read. It's absolutely wonderful. It's written not for technicians, but for the average intelligent person who's interested in the Bible and in archaeology. So he says to me, he says, are you a minimalist or a maximalist? You know what this means, because you read Barr. Minimalist or a maximalist, which means, if you're a minimalist, it means you only believe what is true because the archaeologists have proven that it's true. Everything else is not true. Therefore, among things that didn't happen were the Exodus, the kingship of King David, all these things are fantasy. Why? Because there's no clear proof. Nothing that we have discovered says the Exodus was here, there, according to
King
exactly
David
the way it says.
It was verified by archaeologists.
We're not so sure. The maximalists say yes, it's obvious. I'm arguing the minimalist point of view. Because he says to me, this evangelical minister says, are you a minimalist or a maximalist? So I look him in the eye and I said, Pastor, I'm a maximalist. How about you?
What a question.
So he looks at me and says, Rabbi, we're friends. We're both maximalists. Maximalists say, you assume what the Bible says is true, and you do your archaeology assuming that if the Bible says it and you can figure out here, it's probably you're going to find it. You then find it, and you say, well, that's what I read in the Bible. The minimalist says, you think that you found what you said in the Bible. You found something. It has absolutely nothing to do with the Bible unless it says on the thing itself what you say the Bible says. And of course, that's the minimalists say that. The minimalists say that. Okay? So these kinds of distinctions, these kinds of proofs, are not so different from what we're talking about here. There is a level of tradition, and the tradition, in fact, has its own credibility to it in the community of people that are close to it. But, you know, you're a minimalist or you're a maximalist.
What would Maimonides say about something which, like in the mission it says 3 days, but tradition would say a part of a day?
So it must mean that was not halacha l'Moshe Mitzrayim. Okay, that cannot be for Moses on Mount Sinai. That particular issue could not have been to Moses on Mount Sinai.
Even though it's in the mission.
Correct. Because obviously there's a baraita that we'll get to that. The baraita is going to disagree with it.
The Maimonides concept of what you just discussed is the source of Minhag Avinu Minhagenu?
Minhag Avinu Biyadenu. Is that what you're saying?
Minhag Avotenu Minhagenu.
Minhag, okay, Minhag Avotenu Biyadenu, that we, no, that's actually different.
It's not.
Minhag Avotenu Biyadenu means we do it because it's a custom of our ancestors. The good example of that is the second day of Yom Tov. Second day of Yom Tov. Do you know the source of the second day of Yom Tov was that originally there was a time lag of informing the diaspora when the new month had begun, and therefore there's a time lag of when the 15th day of the month will actually begin. Okay? So that was the reality of the Talmudic period. In our time, that's no longer true. We know when the moon, how do you say, when the crescent appears. We know when that is, and communication is such that there's essentially no lag anymore. So why do we observe 2 days of Yom Tov? The reason is Minhag Avotenu Biyadenu. It's tradition. It's a question of tradition. That we accept that part of a religion develops on the basis of tradition, which is an accretion. It's a series of accretions that develop a religious tradition. And that's Minhag Avotenu Biyadenu. That's different.
And it's not coming because Maimonides says that, you know, if it's not Torah Moshe Mishinai, which was basically Torah Shebal Peh, which was Minhagim.
Exactly. Well, no.
It's not the same Minhagim.
Well, it depends on what you mean by Minhag.
Like the Hevel, the...
But it's not the same. There are different kinds of minhag. If what you mean is that was the custom for Moses on Mount Sinai, that's custom with a capital C, with a capital U and a capital S and a capital T and so on. That's called big stuff. That's big stuff because God said it, okay? But if you're talking about the things that happened after that, that sort of just grew in life, that's usually what we mean by minhag avotenu biyadenu.
So that's bring the issue that, I don't know if you heard, but one of the rabbis in Israel decided that Elat need to have second day of Yom Tov on this coming Pesach.
Elat?
A lot of Orthodox had to cancel their visit to Elat this summer, this season.
Why Elat and not Pesach?
Because Elat is not mentioned in the Bible, and it was outside the territories of Israel.
I will try to pay attention. I've not seen that yet.
Yeah, this is a big issue now.
All right.
That's
a lie.
People who don't have enough to worry about.
Correct. This is very fair.
That's what I said to you, that in the current elections, yeah. It wasn't really about it wasn't about the Palestinians, but it was about economics. Mm-hmm. The religious people who have less, they're not in the world of economics, they're in the world of Torah, that's what they'll fight about.
Doesn't the 30 days come from Aaron's, the morning for Aaron?
Interest, maybe yes. The 30-day period may come from there. However, the fact that 30 days was the time for prohibition against cutting hair, right? We don't, even if we have a 30-day period, we don't know what it consists of. The fact that it consists of cutting hair, we know from this Gezeirah Shavah, because of the Nazarite. Okay? That's the only way we know that. And it's a better proof than to say, if we know that mourning is 30 days, and we can assume that the 7-day period of haircutting, which we know from Aaron and Moses, that extends to 30 days, what right do we have to extend it to 30 days? It's the Gezeirah Shavah that proves that.
It's interesting. I mean, 30 days obviously is more or less a month. It's not a multiple of a week.
Correct.
It's a correct. Funny time.
You're right.
Period.
You're absolutely right.
And of course, it doesn't say a month.
Correct. Doesn't say a month.
It could have said a month, which would have then really planted it in the
interesting idea. You're absolutely right.
And it doesn't say 4 weeks, which would have planted it into mm-hmm. Shabbat, the creation
you're
tradition.
Right.
It's sort of dangling out there in between.
29 and a half.
The calendar. It's not quite.
I have not researched that. That would be an interesting question to research. whether 30 is an approximation of the lunar months.
It's
and
not
that's
an
why it's used.
I just remembered in the Egyptian calendar.
Oh, here we go.
A month, the year was 12 months of 30 days. And there was the 5 days were
days.
In the calendar. They did like festivals and whatever. So the 30 has a root in the calendar.
That'd be interesting then if the source of this is Egyptian. And maybe what we have here is a carryover of certain Egyptian concepts of time.
Yeah, which may have been generalized ancient world.
Yes, exactly, exactly, exactly.
Egyptian mean time.
Egyptian mean time. All right, one more, and then we got to go do a little bit more. Okay, last one.
The question of the second day for Yom Tov,
yes.
Which we ascribe to traditional diaspora.
Right.
The fact is, there is somewhere between a 4 and 8 hour time difference between that area and Israel.
To what area in Israel?
Yes. The time,
Iraq.
The evening time in Israel.
Oh, you mean anyway there's a difference
there's
of time.
Anyway, a factual difference.
Yeah. But I think it could be argued that we would go according to Israeli time.
And you have to get up in the middle of midnight.
So at least you would know when the beginning of the month was. That's the crucial thing. If you know when the beginning of the month is in Israel, okay, if it's Monday, you know that it's on Monday. But if you're not sure if it's Monday or Tuesday, then where you are, even with that time difference, you're not sure when to count that time difference. Is it Monday or Tuesday? You're just not sure. Because there's a lack of precision. It's a lack of precision. If it were precise and we knew when the beginning was, then we could deal with the time difference. But if it's not precise, it's all the result of lack of precision in measurements. Right? And that leads you to just protect yourself on all sides.
We had hourly differentials at that time already.
We had what?
Hourly differentials.
Yes, they knew those things. They knew those things. But the problem was that the month had to be declared by the Bet Din. That was the issue. It was not a matter of astronomical reality. It was a matter of sighting the moon. The Arabs to this day do the same thing. Ramadan does not begin and does not end until there is an actual sighting of a Muslim court that testifies in Saudi Arabia to the fact that the moon has been seen. Doesn't matter what, and I remember being in Israel at this time. They say the Arabs say to you, they say Ramadan ends tomorrow, probably, because Ramadan does not end until the court says that it ends. Then Al Jazeera broadcasts, the court says it's over, and everybody goes on their party, and then that's the end of it. But until the court makes that report, it's not over. It's the same thing in Jewish law. It was exactly the same. Until our calendar became an astronomical calendar, which was in the early time of the Talmud. Okay? Okay, a little bit more. Let's go a little bit further. Okay. 19b, 2 on the right side of the page, halfway down. Okay, we know Miksata Yom Kechulo. That's the point of view of Abba Shaul. Part of the day is a whole day. Amar Rav Huna Bereda Rav Yehoshua. Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yehoshua, says, Hakol Modim. Everybody agrees. Keshechal Shlishi Shalo Liyot Erev Aregel. When the third day of morning of Shiva occurs before the festival begins, Shasur birchitza ada erev, that a person may not bathe until the evening. Okay? Now that's interesting. So we're not saying the seventh day of Shiva, but we're saying the third day of Shiva. We already saw that the third day of Shiva has a certain force to it. Namely, that if 3 days of Shiva occur before the holiday, the Shiva is over. However, we saw that on the seventh day of Shiva, according to Abba Shaul, you can wash, you can bathe after the minyan. So that's Mitzvah Yom Kechula. But here it says, the tradition is Rav Huna, Rav Yoshua. Everybody agrees that the third day, when it is the eve of the festival, that you're not allowed to bathe until the night. Until the night. So obviously there, the third day, Miksata Yom Kechula does not apply. Does not apply.
For Abba Shaul?
Apparently, because it says Hakol Modim. Everybody agrees. What does it say? Yeah, because it says Hakol Modim. Everybody, who's everybody? Includes Abba Shaul. Even Abba Shaul. Okay? Amar Rav Nechemya Bereda Rav Yoshua. Now we're dealing with Amoraim. Ashkachatin hu l'rav papi u'l'rav papa diyatefa ka'amra. I saw these rabbis who sat and said, that is to say, they taught the following, which in effect is an agreement. Halacha k'rav Huna bereda Rav Yoshua. The law goes according to Rav Huna, the son of Rav Yoshua. Now that is to say, therefore, that you, that they are trying to emphasize that even though the Shiva can be canceled in the third day by the Yom Tov, it's still in effect the middle of Shiva. And therefore, we do not have this leniency of Abba Shaul, which is that a part of the day is the whole day. Everybody agrees with that. Abba Shaul agrees with that. And the rabbis who are the Amoraim agree with that as well. Okay? Now, this is also brought in the following way. Igid Diamre, there are those who say, Amar Rav Nechemya, Breder Rav Yosef. The version is reported as follows, that Rav Nechemya, the son of Rav Yosef, said that I saw Rav Papi and Rav Papa, Rav Huna, the son of Yehoshua, sitting and saying, teaching, HaKol Modim She'im Chal Shlishi She'ol Yot Erev HaRegel She'asur Bir Chitza Ad Ha'aref. So it's the same point, but it's a slightly different record of the transmission. Okay? So for our purposes, keep in mind that the 3 days is qualitatively different from the 7 days. And even though we are allowing the Shiva to end because of the regel, none of the leniencies will kick in just because it's 3 days. Everybody agrees, Abba Shaul and all the other rabbis agree, that 3 days is a whole 3 days. The shortened period of time only is at the end of 7 and at the end of 30.
And today, when 1 day is enough, is... it's not a complete full day, is it?
If you will come back in 3 weeks. That is the next subject of the Talmud. Okay? Very good.